From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell, sitting across from a woman who is married, misery and hilarity, from Fleabag to Killing Eve to Fleabag Series 2, which is just about to start on Amazon. Of course, I'm sitting with actress and writer Phoebe Waller-Bridge. Thanks so much for doing this.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And one of the things I wanted to ask you about is, what music do you listen to? Because there's such a musicality to the rhythms of speech in the pieces.
Oh, wow. That's such a good question that I wish I'd been prepared for, because I'm going to have loads of really embarrassing answers.
There's nothing embarrassing. We've seen Fleabag. We know there's nothing embarrassing here.
It's kind of random. And actually, I listen to a lot of music when I'm writing, and it can really inform the emotion of a scene, actually. So talking about this series in particular, I listened to... what did I listen to for this series? Do you mind if I just look at my Spotify list?
I have no issue with that at all.
My Fleabag Spotify list.
Yes, actually, please bring up Spotify on radio. Get another nail in its coffin.
Sorry. Okay, so I listened to this song a lot when I was writing Fleabag 2, which was Leon Bridges' River.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. It had a real spirituality to it and a real depth, and his voice.
It's a very emotional song.
Very emotional song. Yeah, yeah. And I really, and I listened to it over and over again. Then I actually did the Graham Norton show at the same time as him as I was writing it. So he'd sort of been so in my mind. And I sort of went up to him and grabbed him afterwards. And I said, I need to thank you because you're inspiring me so much when I'm writing. And he had no idea what I was talking about. He was like, oh, Jesus Christ. But so that was a big one.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a song called The Lost Song by The Cat Empire.
Yeah.
Oh. That one just makes me feel there's something really urban about it. I think there's something kind of really raw and urban about that sound and the trumpet.
It's funny because these songs you've just mentioned are really songs that are incredibly melancholic.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And I don't want to give too much away, but series two is actually much more melancholic, because the thing I found so interesting as kind of a sort of split between the two is in the first series she's almost always in contact with strangers, and in the second series it's more familiar people, isn't it?
Yeah, my God, that's an observation I hadn't even made myself. Yeah, she relies, I think she relies.
I had a lot of time to think about this while you're looking at your Spotify list.
I can go back if you want to have a bit more time for the next question. I think she was relying on being anonymous in the first one so that she could hide her secret. And then I think that probably translates into the fact that people know her secret, the audience know her secret by the second one, that she actually has to kind of face up to the real people in her life.
But I mean, I do find myself so often thinking in your pieces about the musicality of language and the way each character gets almost like a different solo in it.
There's definitely, yeah, I mean, the rhythm of words is really important to me, and I think the rhythms of how people speak will really help me unlock a character. And performing, particularly the play, being able to tap into characters, I suppose it comes quite naturally, but then looking back at it, that is my way in to play the different ones. Like, I know that Tube Rodent, the character, oh, he's called Bus Rodent because that's where she finds him in the TV show. In the play, she finds him on the tube. Accuracy is paramount. But, you know, he was very sort of staccato and kind of doesn't really know what he's going to say next, so it all suddenly comes out very fast. And then I know that there are other characters who have a much more kind of flowy kind of rhythm.
Well, your godmother, for example, who's it's almost a series of, like, trumpet solos. And she, it's so interesting, too, because the way Olivia Colman plays it, it's like she's imitating what she thinks a mother is supposed to sound like. So there's something that's very kind of maternal about these awful things she's saying. Mm. I mean, it's almost a velvety tone that she delivers these brutal aperçus.
Yeah, yeah. And that idea that she can look and sound and appear and probably smell like a beautiful person, and yet underneath the surface is this kind of... This sort of poison that she sort of spits at Fleabag. And that was such an exciting moment with Olivia when we first were talking about it in the first series, when she was sort of like, how much of this, like, archness do we have to play? And I was like, nothing, bury it, play her like she is the loveliest person in the world.
Because also what songs do is really give a really brief and powerful kind of emotional state. And they also offer a kind of intimacy, which in the second series, it really is a lot more intimate, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I think also that the best kind of music leaves so much interpretation, emotional interpretation, up to you. And I feel like that's the kind of writing I want to do, that you don't give all the answers. You're not manipulative. You don't try and show the whole hand of a character or try and tell an audience how to feel about a character. And I feel like the songs that do that best leave the biggest impression because it feels personal. It feels it's like it's for you in that moment.
We're talking about songs with the creator and star of Fleabag, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, is The Treatment. But I guess I was thinking about that too because I find so much thinking. It's almost like listening if you've got your phone with you, listening to something and the restaurant's playing something else. So two almost discordant pieces of music. I think about those scenes with Fleabag and Boo in the first series and how she almost breathes every time before she speaks. It's like a deep, calming breath that she takes.
Oh, Jenny Rainsford. Yeah. You're so perceptive. My gosh. Yeah, she has. I normally get these sort of observations when I'm talking to people about the show. Thank you. She does do that. And she has an unbelievably grounded sense of self, I think, Jenny. And there's a scene in the second season when it's a very, very, very short but emotional conversation between the two of us when I'm talking about the death of my mother. And, I'm not one of those actors that can just bring it really quickly. Like, if I have to go to an emotional place, I'm like, oh, God, I have to sort of punch my face.
Really?
Punch myself in the eye occasionally. And I have to sort of go away and sort of, I don't know, just work myself up into that a bit. But when I sat down, we did the rehearsal with Jenny, and she's so present and so grounded, and she has that kind of, like you say, that breath that just brings you together really quickly. She just sort of breathes out and you're there. That she just started saying those lines and I just burst into tears, and director Harry was just like, shoot it, she's not going to be able to do this again. Jenny, keep being kind, keep breathing out before you speak.
That's so interesting though, because so much of that character is her trying to keep her emotions at bay through these different, if you pardon the expression, arias that she's delivering, these different kinds of songs. And it's so funny to hear you say that it's not something you have this kind of quick transport to.
Well, I do feel like I did more this season with Fleabag. I found it very difficult when I was at drama school to connect quickly, and there was a lot of pressure, and it was like, if you can't cry, then you're a bad actress. And
I've always thought the opposite, because people do it so easily in America. The people specialize in the single tear, which has become such an awful cliche.
And I've never seen that in real life. No, I mean, who controls that? And if I did do that in real life, I'd have to stop and make everyone look at it. guys.
Now you have to do a series three just so we can see the single
just
tier.
Just a single tier. Yeah, I found it. But really, I think that also came down to I need to really, really believe what's happening in the scene. And I think because I was writing it and I know the actors so well and we all really believed in this situation because we'd been through the first season. The second one did feel very emotional, actually. And actually, it's love underpinning the whole of the second season. And it was the absence of that in the first one. And so there was a kind of release in this one of people really trying to connect with each other that I think helped. And also, we're just such good and great friends. And to come together, having had that journey with the first one, to be able to come and do it all over again, there's an emotionality to that, just everyone being back together again and being truthful. And
Again, just to get back to the musicality, I was thinking about episode 4 in the first series, because I don't want to give too much away for the second series here, when at the retreat where the women are basically told to silence themselves, and all we hear is this constant prattle and noise and banging around from the men's camp across the way, which is really funny too, because it's about trying to find some kind of musicality and calm, and these guys are just behaving like a bunch of teenagers across the way. It's almost like having bad neighbors.
Yeah, I mean, that idea came when I was thinking of the idea that women, again, this is only like retrospectively.
I can help you with English. I've been speaking for a while. It's a native language.
This is my third language. the idea that women are encouraged to be quiet from early on, and men are encouraged to express themselves, and the idea that out of a beautiful silence you can hear slut just really tickled me. And then the idea, I mean, literally started with that idea and then building to what that might be, and that these men are really trying and they've gone to this improvement camp, and that they're really, but the idea of them all earnestly shouting slut at a blow up doll called Patricia felt kind of earnest. It's how earnest they are that made me laugh. But then again, that punctuation of the word slut in amongst this kind of perfect silence was satisfying.
But I was thinking about that too, just because in the first episode, there's that seminar that she attends where we hear the words "opening women's mouths since 1998," which may be one of my favorite lines of all time.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, it's those little ones that I still chuckle at that one, especially because that's my mum. That's my mum playing that character, and she's just immortalised that line for me now.
And for me too. But it's so funny because so much of what you do, and really sort of, I think, I think subtextual terms is about women not waiting for permission to speak. And having these two poles offered in that first series of a woman basically empowering women to speak because, of course, they couldn't do it on their own, and then someone else telling them to shut up.
Yeah.
It's just and Fleabag not really waiting for permission and her sister not being able to shut herself up either. I mean, them being the two most disruptive forces in this.
Yeah, I think permission is a really important word when it comes to, I think, female expression. I think particularly as a writer, even when I was sort of starting to write, I remember having these conversations with Vicky Jones, who's my greatest
director
friend, and she directed the stage show, yeah. And we had this conversation quite early on when we were wondering why there were so many more male writers in their 20s when we were in our 20s and there were female writers. And I remember her saying, I think maybe because women feel like they need to ask permission to be a writer. And that really, really stayed with me. And I think that it feels like there are lots of rules that you can accidentally break. Sort of unspoken rules as a woman that you're supposed to sort of be polite, but you're also supposed to be kind of revolutionary or at the same time, and finding a way around those makes it feel like a performance, I think, for women a lot of the time. Like you have to kind of cleverly be God, what's the best way of describing it? I feel like Fleabag's front is someone who tries to appear to be polite and nice and together on the surface. And particularly that she's got, you know, her clothes, her lipstick, she's together, she's polite. And then the fact that she turns to the camera and tells us what she really thinks feels like she doesn't feel like she can say that in the real world because the impact would be a negative one. When actually the great irony of that is what she says down the camera is, I think, what made the character appeal to people. I know speaking to women who were like, you know, those are the things we secretly say to our friends and we don't say out loud in the world.
I'm going to ask for permission to take a break. My guest is Phoebe Waller-Bridge. She's the creator and star of Fleabag and the creator of Killing Eve. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. I received permission to proceed with the creator and star of Fleabag, Phoebe Waller-Bridge. It's The Treatment. I guess that one of the things I was thinking too, though, is as you were talking about that, how she basically claims permission at the very beginning of the piece. I mean, she's planted a flag for expressiveness and letting us know what's going on. But the fact is, we're so used to characters who do that kind of thing, and for whom language in that space kind of becomes therapeutic, and it does not for her. I mean, saying these things, because she's still not saying them out loud. Mm. We're just hearing her thoughts, but she's not really giving voice to these things that she's thinking. And the tension between what she's thinking and what she actually says is so interesting to me, because I think about that with Sandra Oh's character in Killing Eve as well. She's also this person who's kind of got this closeted inner life.
Mm. And I think that's why they're fun to write, because then you know it's just a ticking time bomb. Because if somebody's not expressing themselves and they're putting a lid on it for whatever reason, but we as an audience can have the occasional little peek behind the curtain and see what's really going on underneath. You just know that is going to raise its fabulous, frightening, brilliant, exciting head at some point. I think that's how I felt a lot of the time when I was growing up as well. Well, I suppose it's in my teens and 20s, just that feeling of like, there's so much stuff I want to say, and there's so many ways I want to behave, and I feel like I can't. And particularly with Eve, that she felt like she should be so grateful for this life that she had, which of course she is and should be, but that it didn't mean, but it's also meant that she was, her life was sort of completed for her, that she shouldn't go, you know, cross over into another emotional sphere or sexual sphere. And Sandra plays that so brilliantly, because it's almost like she's discovering it herself. Eve's discovering it herself all the way along. There's that sort of electricity in Sandra's performance where you just feel like there's something there inside of her, but even she's not really sure what it is yet.
Because it's so interesting too, you've written some of these characters as ostensible archetypes, but when they speak, then there's something else entirely. I mean, and I was to go back to Olivia as your godmother or your sister, or these women who are seem to be one thing. I mean, we even see there's a big reveal with your sister in season two. Everybody thinks that she had one career, but it turns out she's doing something else entirely.
Yeah, because I find that's the experience of meeting people. I think we make such quick judgments, not necessarily negative judgments when we meet people, but I'm just constantly surprised by people just all the time. And it's one of the most wonderful things about talking to people is there'll always be a moment when you go, oh, that's that was surprising. I didn't know that was coming. And I think if you look hard enough and or ask the right questions, everyone will surprise you. And I also think as an audience member, that's all you really want, is to be surprised in an authentic way. So you're not tricked, but you feel like, oh, that surprised me, but yet it feels completely truthful.
But I also guess it's something really interesting and subversive, which it's lived so often in the way you write, is that we realize that nobody's listened to her sister for her entire life.
Yes, they just decided for her that she was a lawyer. Yes. Yeah, exactly. And she's held on to that narrative, Claire. And again, so, I mean, Sean Clifford, who plays it with this intensity, this kind of intense, locked down persona. And she's almost sort of quivering with it the whole time. But, you know, she doesn't, if it cracks, then it feels like the whole thing's going to fall apart for her. And so she'll sort of let them believe. She probably knew in some way that they all kind of thought she was a lawyer, and just no one's ever actually said it. And then in that moment they say it, and she just has to correct them in this moment. I don't know, but I think that also gives an actor something to play, you know, when you give them an outer and an inner, and the more opposite they can be, the better.
See, that's why I kept going to the music so often, because I think about this in terms of actors' exercise, and so often I've talked to actors who say, well, you know, I'll try to think about a way to play something that's not in the text. And so sometimes they'll say it's a piece of music that's in my head, and I'll use that to deliver. So it gives it a different kind of import. Mm-hmm. But the way you've written these characters is you've given them ways to play that, both the outer and the inner, and the dialogue is almost always incidental to what they're really feeling.
When I'm writing, I think it's useful, having been an actor and knowing so many actors, and actually that experience of being there and knowing you've only got one thing to play in a scene is quite a exposing thing. So you have to bring so much of yourself to just that one narrative. But if you give, to play scared is one thing. To play scared and turned on at the same time is so rich for an actor. And I feel like that's what, you know, a lot of Eve was about. You know, she was frightened, but she couldn't stop moving forward towards the fire. And then I think you've got this pull, and the more conflict you have to play, the more interesting the character will be.
It's interesting, because so much of what happens in what you write is there's surprise in every scene. Somebody is caught off guard by something and shocked by something. And I just wonder if that's an experience that you want to, that you found yourself at some form of part thinking. That's something I want to create, because the idea of frustrating and upending expectation will keep people interested, but also give actors something to play as well.
Yeah, and I think it's completely, and I think it reminds audiences and an actor that they're living in a real world. And I think I think there's so many things to take in when you're watching something that people neglect, like just putting two people who have to have a very serious conversation in a room that is unbelievably hot. You instantly know that there's going to be, you know, they don't want to admit to each other about how hot it is in that room. You just, there's something so human about that. And it reminds you that you're in the real world, that you're in the real world and they're in the real world. And they're having to, you know, break news to each other, but they're also incredibly sweaty. I don't know. There's just all these little challenges that you can put in front of an actor. And I always think, really, watching people eat is such a powerful thing, because because it's real, and somebody having to sort of speak. And I think that's why actors like props, because it just roots it in something.
I guess I was thinking about that too, just because so often there's so much talk about food in what you do. I mean, you mentioned that people are constantly talking about food, aren't they?
Because I think about it quite a lot. And I also think I talk about it quite a lot. Like, I know, like, I'm always thinking about when lunch is and what I'm going to have for lunch. And if someone's got, like, the little things really crack me up. Like, if people have carried, like, a snack in their bag, like they've got a snack, and that they, I don't know, like, and it's a very particular type of chocolate. I don't know. I just think that's, like, endearing and just says so much about them. Or people choosing, I'm just going to sound totally mad now, but when you go into, like, a sandwich shop and there's, like, four people just standing up in front of the sandwiches, just taking ages to decide which sandwich they want. In that moment, the stakes are so high because you get the wrong sandwich and your day is gone. But I think it's those little moments when, and again, that would be a perfect, like, that's already a scene I want to write. Like, people who know they have to listen to the person they're standing next to, but God, they need to check, you know, they need to choose the right sandwich and haven't got much time and it's important.
My guest was literally whetted my appetite is Phoebe Waller-Bridge. She's the star and creator of Fleabag on Amazon here in the States. It's The Treatment. Gosh, but it's so interesting to talk to somebody who's trained as an actor who writes, because what they're trying to do is give subtext, because, as you know, you're often playing things that don't have it, and so you're looking for it. Mm. And just to do these things that give actors any number of things to concentrate on raises the stakes for them and gives them a bigger investment in the material, doesn't it?
Mm-mm. I think the level of naturalism makes, you know, I write in a kind of very urban environment for Fleabag, so it's sort of around sandwiches and things like that. But I think it can be done. I think is it in Children of Men where Clive Owen has to escape, but he hasn't got any shoes. It's just an amazing detail, because you can instantly know that raises the stakes to such a huge, huge level, and such a simple thing to do, and you have so much more empathy in him, and we can kind of relate to his struggle and his escape so much more in that moment, because we've all had to at some point walk over something uncomfortable without any shoes on. And I think that's such a clever twist, and I think it's just those little tiny additions that can completely transform a character's journey.
I guess I was thinking about food too, just because so often what people want to eat tells us who they are. Mm. And it's a really interesting way to give us a sense of who some person is very quickly, isn't it?
Yes, yes. I think food, sex, and what makes people angry says something very, very quickly about who they are. And I think that's a really great way into to have a character surprise you. Because there'll be characters that you would never think would order, like, an entire chicken for their dinner. But there are people you could go to dinner with and they'd order the entire chicken and you'd be like, I did not expect that. But you're right, you can learn so much, because it's choices, it's about people. And I do think the best, you know, the best scenario you can ever put your character in is when they have to make a choice. And going from the mundane, whether or not you want a full chicken for your dinner, or and then ultimately to the epic, which is, you know, the kind of staple kind of Greek huge choices that people have to make, you know, Sophie's Choice level of choices. And I mean, I have, like, a mantra that I always say to myself when I'm writing, which is go Greek or go home. Like, every story should reach those levels, and every decision should have its own stakes. But ideally, the story at its heart should in some way be sort of Greek.
It's interesting because so much of that is about letting us know who somebody is immediately in Greek drama, just because the stakes are scaled in such an epic way. And what's so fascinating about your work is you're very specific with characters very quickly. And I just wonder if that was something that was instinctive for you.
I think it was instinctive because I think I like watching somebody and feeling like I understand them very quickly just from their little tics or their little the things that make them specifically them. Like in Killing Eve, in a very early scene in an office, they're having to have a very serious discussion with Carolyn Martins, the head of the Russian desk, about an assassination. But they're all really hungover because they went to karaoke night the night before. And one of the guys at the at the meeting wasn't invited to the karaoke party the night before. And I think that just, I don't know, like it just brings it alive for me because I just feel like the stakes in the room then, the real personal stakes, are between those three people and why one of them wasn't invited to the birthday party. And the other two are clearly, I mean, he clearly wasn't invited because they, you know, purposely not invited. And the others have very, very clearly had a brilliant time. And yet in every other, not every other, but in a lot of dramas I'd seen about assassins or when people in intelligence have been sat around a table, you know, they're trying to force the stakes down our throats, saying the stakes here are that somebody has died. And there has been a murder. And I feel like these are people who deal with that every single day. They go, this person's died, there's been a murder, but my God, Frank wasn't invited to karaoke. It's like, just feels more, I don't know, more relatable or accessible to me.
Oh, I think it is too, but it also because so much of what you do is about characters judging other people and making these instantaneous judgments that so often prove to be wrong.
Yeah.
That offering that kind of apparent vividness that can be misread because of the self-absorption of the people making the judgments is, again, there's so many these conflicts that you scale in these pieces.
Yeah, I think the self-absorption thing is appealing to write because it makes people blind to what's going on around them. And then you can see how a character projects themselves by how they treat other people.
But we're also kind of aware, too, because of the way these opposing forces live so closely in your work, of the vulnerability in that. I mean, these comic moments are so often about people's Achilles heels being exposed, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I feel, and again, Achilles heels, you know, it's Greek. We've got to go there.
That was completely unintentional on my part. I wish it were not, but that idea of this constant exposure of vulnerability, even that's what makes Killing Eve so different from the book, is that idea of people's sort of hearts being exposed so often, mm-hmm. and having to deal with these emotional bruises at the same time they're trying to go forward with real earth-shaking work.
Yeah, thank you. I feel like that'll always be the point, is vulnerability is always the goal of a character. And I think just to know what their vulnerability is, to know what their fears are and what's the worst thing that could happen to them. A lot of, you know, I remember sort of when I was trying to learn about writing, a lot of people would say, what's your character's super objective? And I'd find that very difficult to articulate because I don't know many people who know what their super objective is in their own lives. I couldn't tell you what mine is sort of emotionally. But when I started thinking about it in terms of what would be the worst thing that could happen to this character and then breaking it down to what would be the worst thing in this conversation that could happen and then what could be the worst thing in this day and what could be the worst thing in this week, in this year, in this relationship, you know, all those things. And I suddenly, that for me really helps define who it is because then you know that their super objective is just to stop that thing from happening. To stop that fear from being realized. And then that's the engine behind the characters.
Well, my super objective is to wrap this thing up because we're out of time. See, that's what we call symmetry here in the radio business. My guest is Phoebe Waller-Bridge, the creator and star of Fleabag. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you.
Recording engineer here at NPR West is Josh Newell. The show is mixed by Kat Yor, edited by Blake Pite, who's associate producer. I'm going to go get something to eat. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.